You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Al Gonzalez. Al, it's good to have you here.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
So the way the show begins is with a huge question. Who are you? What do we need to know about the values you aspire to live by, the things you've done, the labels you wear to start this conversation?
So I'll start with the end of the story, and then I'll go back to understand me, you've got to go back to the beginning.
Yep.
If I were to tell you who I am, I'm somebody who's actually facing fear in the face and telling it, I just don't care. After 30 years of a pretty good, successful executive career, I walked away. Last 20 years were at Cornell. Great times. Sometimes at the end, it wasn't so good. But I'm a lover of fitness, and it is my passion, so I'm actually doing what a lot of people say, go find what you love to do, and you'll never work another day in your life. So I am somebody who can tell you, I'm working harder than ever to do what I love to do, and for probably a lot less than I ever made before. However, I meet people like you at my job, so I'm definitely doing that. Excuse me. If you were to know who I am, I'm a minority. I was an island boy, grew up in Puerto Rico, Gonzales. So I had a tough go at it my first 15 years. My dad was a tennis father coach in tennis, and it was tough, but my mother was my rescue. She was my angel, and she literally plucked me out of the island and got me to an opportunity to move to the States at 15. So I left home at 15. And by choice, I had a choice. I could go to New York City and live with my aunt, who was my father's sister, or go to Geneseo, SUNY Geneseo, live with my mother's sister. And she was married to an art professor at SUNY Geneseo. And I got to Geneseo, moved in there. I wanted the quiet. I wanted the green. I wanted no city. I wanted no pollution. And lo and behold, my aunt and I didn't get along. They kicked me out. I meet this local doctor from town who's an intermediate tennis player but loved the game of tennis. So we meet through tennis. He ends up adopting me, and in 3 years, changes my life, teaches me what it means to be a responsible young man. And I graduate with honors from high school, graduate with very good grades from college, first one to graduate from college in my family. So I was blessed to know him. He's a huge influence in my life to this day. And I then made a very good, successful career for myself, ended up meeting a woman from Dryden, New York, who was also in SUNY Geneseo. And we got married, had kids. She's a great friend of mine today. The marriage has evolved into a friend relationship. We were going through a long separation, but we're best friends. But we did very well together. We did well professionally, provided my children a very good life. And I hit 50, and things just got really, really tough for me professionally. So instead of trying to keep fighting to keep that life and what it brought, I just pursued my passion of fitness, and here I am today trying to live my dream. Mm-hmm. And that's how I met you.
Yeah. So let's cut to music. We brought several pieces with you. What would you like for us to start with?
Let's start with the Spanish song by Mijares called Que Nada Nos Separe.
Here we go.
En la ventana, una nube mañana lo veremos correr junto a la ventana. Ahí te miraré, yo te miraré. Cuando se va el sol, siento tu calor. Cuando estamos lejos, igual llega tu voz. No existe la distancia ni el tiempo, mi amor. No hay nada en este mundo que nos separe a los dos. Que nos separe a los dos. Cuando se va el sol, siento tu calor. Cuando estamos lejos, igual llega tu voz. No existe la distancia ni el tiempo, mi amor. Que nos separe a los dos, que nos separe a los dos.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Al Gonzalez. So Al, the question I go to next is you know what you've already named some major things that you've gone through. But what did you have to learn about life to know the life you want to live? What did you have to learn? What did you have to go through? Because you've given us some markers, but yeah, we don't know quite how or why those things work.
Yeah. So that's a great segue into the reason that I picked this song. And the answer to your question is mentors. I have had these lifelong mentors, and my mother was really the first one, much more than my dad. My dad was a tennis mentor or athletics person in my life, but she was a mentor. So mentors have come in my life at very, very critical times, and my mom was the first one. In the song Que Nada Nos Separe, we played that when I left. At 15, I left my home.
Mm-hmm.
But the song means that nothing separates us through the distance. I'm in snowy Geneseo, and I'm talking to my mother long distance in a beautiful, 80-degree island. But I understood that mentors are with you, whether they're with you close by, physically, or they're far away. And knowing that she was still there for me and a huge influence in my life, thousands and thousands of miles separating us, climates separating us. That was actually one of the first, my first experience with a lifelong mentor, who, of course, my mother is going to be that. But if you compare that to my dad, who was absolutely not a mentor.
Right. And hardly present, it sounds like.
He was present in a very critical way, so I actually wanted him not to be.
Right.
And that's what ended up hurting in the future, and we'll get into that later. But so to answer your question, Eric, it's these mentors have come into my life and just helped me, and that's a great segue to where I met Dr. Levin, because he was a doctor at the time, surgeon in Geneseo, and he was the next mentor of my life and just shaped my life.
So what did you have to go through to kind of connect with him?
Yeah.
What did he teach you? What was the setting or the way in which you learned from him?
So he taught me humility from somebody who was probably one of the richest people in town.
And how did he do that?
So I left Puerto Rico at 15. I could have told you that I knew everything about life. And I really believed it, which was a scary part.
Sounds like a pretty good 15-year-old.
Right. and I had enough courage to believe in my belief of that I said, I can go anywhere in this world. And I barely spoke English. I spoke most than a lot of people did in Puerto Rico, but it's different when you come to the States growing in a Spanish-speaking island. It's more Spanglish. But having said that, so Dr. Levin drove a Porsche year-round. it didn't matter to him. He's like, I'm going to spend all these money, thousands of dollars in this car. He drove it year round. And he took me to one of his eye surgeries once, and I saw what he did. And this man was just so accomplished. And yet, he brings me in into his home, and he adopts me, this kid from nowhere. Later, I find out that my cousin, my aunt's son, had literally broken into his house to steal his stereo. And he never told me that until I graduated from high school.
Wow.
So I never knew this. Anyway, to answer your question, he was an incredibly accomplished, very, very, you know, well-to-do man, had built himself from nothing.
And he was single, or?
No, I had a family. He had two kids.
Yeah, they were gone, or?
The son was my age, mm-hmm. and he had a younger daughter who was about 11 when I moved in. And anyway, so he just teaches me how to be a hard worker, and he taught me how much I didn't really know about life when I saw how much he knew about life. Mm-hmm. And I really started saying, I got to pay attention to this dude, because he knows what he's doing. He is onto something that I have never seen before. So he really taught me the meaning of hard work and humility and not thinking that you know it all.
So what was he? So you said hard work and humility, but what was he on? How did you ferret out what he was onto? Or how did he get satisfaction is what I'm trying to say.
Oh, how did he get satisfaction?
Yeah, what fed him to go ahead and live by hard work and humility? What?
Yeah. He was a self-made man. His parents came from very, very poor origins, and they built a business from really hard work, and he was the second generation from that, so he was driven. And when I met him, I'd be very specific, I never read a book in my life. It was just this blind ignorance of, yes, I know everything, but without knowing, I've studied anything.
Okay.
So he taught me, look, to make it, you know, you may want to do and be the way you want to be, but you really got to work your butt off to get to the point where you can sustain yourself and live the life that you think you want to live, because this is hard.
Okay.
So he taught me that I really needed to drop my act and just be humble and start reading and really learning about a lot of things that I didn't think I needed to learn in life
mm-hmm.
when I was a kid, like the humanities and philosophy and poetry and art. He was a classical music. Oh my gosh, he played classical music. Jazz. Like, he took me to a bar in Toronto where these cats were just, they were just playing. And he's like, this is what music is, Alfonso. These guys have been playing their whole life so they can do this, and look at their joy. So he exposed me to people that were on top of their game, and somehow that drove him, and drives him to this day. Whenever I come visit him in Rochester, he married again and all that, but whenever we sit down for dinner, I shut up and I listen, because he's the wealth of, every time it's just like, okay, time to sponge everything he's got to teach me.
So you were living with your mother's sister mm-hmm. and husband and their kids.
Yeah.
And one of them was your age, or was he the one who broke into this stuff?
Yeah, so both of them were older.
Both of them were older.
My cousins, I had a female cousin who was 20, and she was in the Philippines through the Peace Corps. And then Jesse, who was actually a rebel hippie, just living in basements and trying to pursue his art, but he was dirt poor. And he was the one that had broken into Dr. Levin's house. Yeah. Yeah. So so that's where I transitioned from a life of 80 degrees, or I think the coldest I'd ever been was 69 degrees.
Right.
And that's where I get to experience. I moved in the summer.
Mm-hmm. Right. It was false advertising. It was bait and switch.
But then the fall comes and all the colors change. I've never seen anything like Letchworth Park. I've never been to Letchworth Park.
Oh, yes.
But my goodness.
What year did you come?
So it was 1984. Mm-hmm. 1984.
Yeah.
Right. So I go to Letchworth Park, and first it's the summertime, and I'm meeting all these new people, and I was the Puerto Rican with long hair and earrings, so I was the top of the town. everybody wanted to hear this accent and wanted to go meet me and go skateboarding with me, and they watched me play tennis. And I was this thing that just showed up one day,
yeah.
right? Very unusual.
You were one of the exotics.
I was, right. So, but then they took me places. I met great people, and they would take me to Letchworth, and I start experiencing the change of seasons, you know? Mm-hmm. And of course, I'm living with Dr. Levin, who's actually telling me what this is. And,
right.
You know, this happens, and everything dies in the fall. And then you go through this long period of darkness, and it's cold and yucky, and then spring comes, and there's a rebirth. And that's what living in a northern town, and this is going back to my mother, like mm-hmm. she was listening to this song on MTV in Puerto Rico, and she would tell me that every time it came up, the video, she would think about me, and the video is very much a fall song. Mm-hmm. And by this point, I get adopted. My aunt kicks me out in the summer. We start school in September. I get adopted around September.
So you get kicked out before school starts.
Didn't take me long.
Yeah.
It was just amazing how he adopted me, and then he just immediately started teaching me, and I remember, like, I made a conscious, to answer a question, an earlier question, something told me, I'm not going to blow this one. When I moved into this guy's house, I'm talking, he's got $38,000 rugs hanging, you know, Oriental rugs, and he's teaching me why they're worth that, and the artistry, and he flips them to the back and says, this is what stitching is, and this is how they're doing. So I go into this, and I'm like, this one, I will not ever do anything that I was doing before. And I was doing quite a bit. And something I haven't told you is my best friend in Puerto Rico, a few years after I leave, ends up getting murdered by the cartels. And we were influenced by the cartels before they were called the cartels.
Right.
We were just calling gangas. But they were actually, it was organized crime that was maneuvering the drug traffic in the Caribbean. And Puerto Rico is a huge hub.
Right.
And they would recruit people like me and Juan Carlos to get into the private school system and push their product with all kinds of sinister ways. Anyway, I tell you that to tell you that when I move into...
And that's part of why you got out of Puerto Rico.
Yeah, and my mother saw it so clearly. Mm-hmm. I didn't really see the danger. Mm-hmm. I was like, nothing was going to touch me, right? So 3 years later, Juan Carlos never comes home, and then they find his shoes in the back of a car, and the car was burned. So, and we never saw him again. So she quite literally rescued me.
Mm-hmm.
But I tell you all that to say that when I walk into Dr. Levin's life, I'm like, this I'm not giving up on. And I will never do the stuff that I was doing. And I behaved myself for years until I then graduated from high school. And then I started drinking and just doing what normal 18-year-olds do. But
right.
From 15 to 18, I didn't put anything in my body that wasn't supposed to be.
Right.
And I just educated myself, and I was influenced by this man, and he really taught me how to live.
Right, and so he impressed you, mm-hmm. but what about you was available to be impressed?
Yeah, so that's interesting, because I would always thank him for teaching me in such ways that I would understand, because he would, like history, for example, he would just teach me about history or art or music. And I would tell him, we would always go to Rochester. He belonged mm-hmm. to this nice club in the wintertime, so we would actually have court time. And then the way there and the way back, we would talk in the car. And he would just constantly play music. And anything that he was teaching me about, I said, damn, thank you. Gosh, I wish you could be a teacher in high school so I could learn this way. And he would tell me, this is the answer to your question. He would say, Alfonso, you've got it. I'm just showing it to you the way that you are understanding it. I have no idea what he was saying, but now being an older person and a parent,
was he saying?
He was saying, you've got potential, you're an intelligent human being, but you gotta listen, you gotta learn, and you gotta put your work in.
Right.
And you gotta pick a direction and follow it.
You've got the curiosity, the capacity, and the raw power.
Yeah, very raw.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. No, I was an exchange student in Colombia, in Pereira.
Yeah.
And I came from a subsistence farm in northwest Missouri. I had more in common with the domestic help than I did with the family of ophthalmologists that I stayed with.
Gotcha.
And I came home halfway through the school day and had lessons on how to eat properly and how to talk properly and behave, because those were some very basic life lessons that growing up on a subsistence farm, I had not really learned.
Ah, interesting.
So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, the funny thing is the first time he taught me what pate was, I had no idea. And had I known, I wouldn't have tried it. But I tried it and it was delicious.
Yeah.
But that kind of like, I had the same kind of experience. He would take me to these restaurants, sure. And I'm like, God, what is the other fork for?
So sweet.
It's like, and he would teach me these. So I hear you. We had a common experience there. Yeah. And he was the one that would teach me these things. He liked it. He enjoyed just kind of preparing me.
Yeah, and it doesn't sound like you didn't perceive him as being condescending or lecturing. He was just taking you into the space, just taking you into the reality.
Yeah, and I think that's what I mean by humility. Because in Puerto Rico, I went to private school. And to be a teacher, you had to be so accomplished. And you had, you know, some of them were PhDs. And I associated learning with arrogance or teachers with arrogance.
Or condescension.
Very much. Yeah. The joke that I tell people is that I left the island because I didn't want to go through my 10th grade Spanish teacher, who everybody hated. She was just a piece of work. Señora Torres. And
yeah. They called her La Dictadora here.
Okay. Yeah, and that's pretty much what she was. And a funny story is it was field day, my 9th grade. This is the year I left. And I never wore a shirt. And she, at the bleachers, screams at me like 15 bleachers apart. Alfonso, ponte la camisa. Alfonso, put your shirt on. And I look at her, and they're not the whole student body, but a lot of us were there. And I scream at her, I am not in the school setting. You don't tell me what to do. The next day, I'm in the principal's office. And she's telling me, I don't care where you are in this island, if Señora Torres tell you to do something, you do it. And it was tough.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of stuff that I was doing.
Yeah.
But anyway, going back to Dr. Levin, he didn't teach me from that, you know, I'm on the pedestal and you're just an idiot you're lucky that I'm here.
Yeah.
He was humble in his teaching, and he taught me the lesson without the attitude. Right?
And he could be an intermediate tennis player and that would be good enough.
Yeah. And that was what was in it for him, because he's very competitive.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to learn. And he saw the efficiency of having me not only on the court, we would watch games, and we would talk about why is he coming to the net and why is he going to the forehand, what's the approach?
Is he intuiting?
So he was. We developed a relationship, and I, of course, and then that's how I later I was telling you I became a teacher myself. So I was teaching him about tennis, loving that this man would listen to me about anything. So I had something to give.
So, but it was reciprocal.
He's teaching me about life, and I'm teaching him about this game.
Yeah,
and which I hated competing, but I love playing.
To teach.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's sweet.
Yeah,
that's sweet. What should we play next musically?
So let's do Live in the Northern Town, because that's where it's at at that point in my life.
Cool.
Hey, my, 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 my the station. No, you never would wave goodbye. You could see it written in his eyes as the train rolled out of sight. Bye.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest is Al Gonzalez. Your life seems to have been a fairly big series of surprises to you.
Mm-hmm.
Although there was a long time where you were married and working and stuff in there.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about when things were kind of at the peak of that first good after you launched from college. What was your life like then?
Yeah, so after college, my wife, but at that point we weren't married yet, but we moved in together. Mm-hmm. And I went to grad school in Ithaca College. So I graduated from Geneseo and I moved to Ithaca College, to go to Ithaca College. And my cousin, probably you know him, Jorge Cuevas, he's a percussionist in town. Awesome. So he was my, growing up, he came to visit me in Puerto Rico. He was 18 and I was 10, and he was Jorge. he was the god, you know,
uh-huh.
He was tall. And
but he's not was the cousin in Geneseo or not a different cousin?
No, this is Jorge here.
Yeah.
So at the time he went to Ithaca College.
I see.
So anyway, so to answer your question, so Amy was from Dryden. I graduated from grad school, and she was in a speech pathology, and she very quickly got recruited. She was very bright, and a lot of, like, recruiters just saw her, and they just picked her. So she was successful rather early. She moves to, right out of grad school, she gets a pretty good job traveling, the traveling company in Northern Virginia and D.C. at the time. I graduated in corporate communications and multimedia. So Northern Virginia was right outside D.C. in Dulles, right outside. And we got a little apartment there. Long story short, we were pretty successful pretty quickly. We were in D.C. Then she got this incredible opportunity, making more than we were both making in D.C. in Florida. So we moved to the climate. It didn't take me long. It was a little bit rough transitioning, but it didn't take me long. I got hired in a company called Motorola, which at the time had split their stock 3 times in a row, and they were putting satellites in space, and it was just, they were really going forward, and I got hired, and I became the manager of a team of 4 or 5 people who were in their 40s at the time, and I was 25.
Wow.
And it was the Mack Mansion and the properties and no, you know, double income, no kids. She was out earning me, and I was quickly approaching 6 figures, and she was out earning me.
Yep.
Nicely. So we were traveling. I mean, we're talking San Francisco for a week and the wine country and Colorado and
a life of privilege.
We were doing just. Yeah. And then Dr. Levin would come down and, you know, $1,000 cases of wine. And so it was successful. I became an executive very quickly. From Motorola, I got recruited into CBS Sports, which I hated. They gave me all this stock options and all this stuff because they wanted me for my bilingual and my tennis and everything. It was actually CBS Sports Line. It was their online presence. Mm-hmm. They wanted to compete with ESPN at the time. And we were doing online sports recreation with computer graphics.
Mm-hmm.
So, did really well, but the CVS, I literally had to bring my daughter down. She was 6 months old, and I literally had to bring them down. I worked 30 miles south of our house in our little McMansion in Wellington, Florida. I was working in Fort Lauderdale, and I did not see them. I was leaving at 5 in the morning, coming home at 7:30 or 8. She was already sleeping.
Right.
I wasn't seeing my daughter. She was just born. And I remember bringing them down to the hotel down the street from my office so that I could have dinner with Amy and Hannah. And then they would go to sleep, and I would just go back to the office at 4 or 5 in the morning. And this is when September 11 happens. So, 9-1-1. And around that time, they were paying me all this money, Eric, and I hate it. That's when I found out you can't buy happiness.
It right.
didn't make any sense, because they were saying, we're giving you three papers a year. We don't care that you're a dad. Bravo for you. You need to go and do all this stuff. And so Amy and I were looking to get back here. And I had interviewed with E. Cornell at the time doing online learning. I was her first director of production there. So I ended up getting a job, and I remember I interviewed the week before September 11. I was here, and then I flew back, and September 11 happens. And it didn't take long after that where we just sold a lot of properties, and Amy didn't work for 2 years, and she's full-time mom. We bought this little nice house in Groton, and I came back. But at the height of our career, to answer your question, we did really well, and we saved a lot of money, and we were very, because of Dr. Levin, and this is where my dad's influence too, my dad was always good at saving and having something.
Right.
He didn't make the money that Dr. Levin made by any means.
But he saved.
But he was very cautious.
Right.
Because he grew up in the Depression. So, so to answer your question, it was good. We did really, really well. And we had the finer things. And we would travel with the kids for 2 week vacations, you know, and Amy wasn't working. So we were, you know, enjoying life. And the kids had a really good earlier part of their life. Yeah.
Neat. Well, let's stop here, and what should we play musically at this moment?
So let's go to, I think we should get into my awareness, and let's go into War by Bob Marley, because that's important.
Sure.
Until the philosophy, which old one raised superior and another inferior, is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned. Everywhere is war. It's a war that until they're no longer first class and second class citizens of any nation, until the color of a man's skin is of no more significance than the color of his eyes, miss a war that until the basic human rights are equally guaranteed to all without regard to race, it is a war that until that day the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality will remaining but a fleeting illusion to be pursued but never attained. Now everywhere is war. War. And until the ignoble and unhappy regime that hold our brothers in Angola, in Mozambique, South Africa, subhuman bondage, have been toppled, totally destroyed. Well, everywhere is war. Miss a war. War in the heat.
rumors of a war. And until that day, the African continent will not know peace. We Africans will fight, we find it necessary. And we know we shall win, as we are confident in the victory of good over evil. Good over evil, yeah. Good over evil. Good over evil, yeah. Good over
evil. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Al Gonzalez. So, Al, you wanted to make a transition here. What's the next turn in this story?
So, I think a good way to connect this to reggae. So music has been a huge influence in my life, and I started playing in college drumming after when I first saw Jorge Cuevas again. He was playing at the Nines.
Yep.
Playing the congas at the Nines. My cousin.
Yeah.
Like, I was a freshman in college and in high school. I was 18. And I see this guy, bang, you know? So I got to play. So I started playing the drums. And he started teaching me congas, and I got a trap kit at home, a pro kit. And but there was something about the two and the four that I was just not on.
Right.
And I remember playing with this bass player who looks at me and goes, Alfonso, playing music with you is like windsurfing. Because you're holding, it's almost like you're, like we are the wind and you're pulling on us. And that pull was the one and the three. I think growing up in the islands with the calypso, and I think salsa's more than the two and the four, but I had a huge, I heard calypso drumming and reggae drumming from a very early age. So, but in addition to learning how to play music, so by the time that, you know, you're telling me how I did in my career and I became very successful, so part of going from 18 to 35, 36, when I was really, well, I was an executive, quote unquote, the progression in those years was becoming an okay musician, becoming a drummer that couldn't play the way that you or Jorge can play. Like, I could never play the rudiments the way that you or your partner, but I can play.
That's not the kind of drummer I am.
I knew enough to appreciate, and also Dr. Levin taking me to see jazz drummers. I knew enough to appreciate what a good drummer was. So I started really appreciating reggae into my later years in college. But there was another part of it. And the reason that I picked war is because being a Puerto Rican in this country and marrying a white girl from Dryden, whose mother is a partner to this ZZ Top, you know, beard, long beard, lumberjack carpenter from Berkshire. I was exposed to families that I would have never met other than meeting Amy and then becoming part of that family. And I'm talking about people that this man, Gary Livingston, who today is Popeye, is recently my child. He's been a co-parent to my kids. I trust him with everything. This man literally gave me the shirt off his back one day. It happened. Like, I was cold in his property, having bonfires, and it was chilly. And I'm like, Gary, I'm freaking cold. He didn't bring my sweatshirt. He pulled his sweatshirt and he gave it to me. The reason I tell you all that is because it was an interesting way to become part of the family that otherwise would have never been exposed to me, and I would have never been exposed to them. Very different views. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm getting at.
Yep.
Different vocabulary. Words came out in those settings that I never thought I would hear. And I'm listening to Bob Marley about war and the philosophy that holds.
Words as in political attitudes or slurs or prejudicial comments or, yeah.
Coming from people that are raising my children and that I trust.
Right.
Right? So this is where I'm like, there is a lot of good in these people, and there's this cultural difference. Right?
Right. And there are expressions of disdain or judgment that have particularly racist overtones that They are racist, but they are also just expressions of disdain.
Yeah. The first time I met Amy's grandfather, who was Don Melberg, who I adored, the first time I came to their house, so I had no idea about any of this, Erica, but I am everybody in this family, and they're all giants. I think Amy's the only person under 5'6". And I mean, the tallest one is 6'7". And blonde and white. And so I walk into this house, and Don Melberg was the mayor of Freeville at one point, and he was the man, right? And I walk in, and he, quiet everywhere, and he comes right up to me, shakes my hand real hard, and pulls me way into him. Mm-hmm. He goes, looks me in the eye, goes, "Well, you're all right." And then everybody laughs, and I'm like, okay, I'm all right. You know? And it was a way that I was, he knew that he had to do something in their vocabulary, in their style, but he was the man to say to everybody, he's welcome here.
Right.
And
right.
That is the experience that I had.
And it's a drama that's a little scary when you go through it, because you don't know it's coming or exactly what it is.
I was so naive that I didn't think it would happen to me. I didn't understand it until years later.
Yeah.
And this is the reason I pick war. Because even though I have that experience, and my daughter has done some really interesting work, she's going into journalism at Northwestern, and she's Gonzalez, but she doesn't look like me. Well, she looks physically like me, but she's more white than I am. Anyway, to make a long story short, when I go through my college years and Bob Marley, not only am I understanding this, why I have a struggle with the 2 and the 4, but I'm always on the 1 and 3. So I start playing reggae, and then I'm in,
right.
You know, musically. But then I'm listening about what he's saying. What he's saying, he's talking about racism and class war and why there is war in this world. So that's when I start, you know, the purpose in my life is like, I love teaching. I move in with a Jewish doctor who, if the people that I grew up listening to at church would tell me that he's going to go burn in hell because he doesn't believe in Christ, but yet he rescues me and he teaches me about my life, how to be a good man, and my cousin breaks into his house and he forgives him and brings me to this. So I'm going through all that, but reggae was this musical influence and this interesting way of saying a musical expression will bring themes that are very difficult to talk about. And you play a song, and there's the message in that song. It's in the radio. You're not saying it, but you listen to it, and it brings the theme into context of wherever you are.
Right.
And that's the reason that I bring up war as a song that I wanted to talk about, because it taught me that anybody, going back to what you were asking me earlier about what Dr. Levin taught me, it's like, Bob Marley busted his ass from an early age to play the music. He was starving poor because all he wanted to do was play music. And he became very successful because he was truly dedicated and behaved in a way that was what he wanted to do. He followed his passion. And that plays on later in my life, because when I'm being successful and the trips and the kids and the thing, it's, I was living a professional life that I was like, wasn't really... It never really hit it for me until I worked at the hotel school, which is the only part of my career that I truly enjoyed, because Puerto Rico was Puerto Rico because of the hotel school from Cornell.
Right.
That to me is like the hard work of Bob Marley, the fact that he could bring all this global theme into the context of the world's fabric, a dreadlock rasta from little Kingston, Jamaica, right? And there he is playing in Europe and traveling the world and driving BMWs in Jamaica, and he's made it, right? So that had a huge influence in me. So I'm watching Dr. Levin make it in the establishment, and then I'm seeing Bob Marley kind of being his free spirit and doing this worldwide thing. And those things were very influential to me, and that's why I picked up a war.
Cool. Yeah. You are headed into this really, you've already launched into this big transition.
Yeah.
And you made the comment about fear. Mm-hmm. What is the fear? Was the hotel school a job that you left, or was it one after the hotel school?
It was the one after hotel school.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So what do you want to say about what failed for you? and why you had to get out?
So the hotel school, when I got to the hotel school, it was a little too good to be true. Like, I thought that to my late 40s, I was 46, 47 at the time, and I was working with people that had been at the hotel school for 20, 30 years.
Right.
So I'm thinking, I am part of this culture. I grew up as a product of what hospitality brings to an island. So I was thinking, this is going to be my next 15 years. I'm retiring from this place, and I'm having the best part of my life, professionally, personally, all that stuff.
What happened?
And then there was something called the College of Business that just basically merged three schools together, and it became this thing that the hotel school just wasn't.
Right.
And it was just tough. We went from, the hotel school had a brand that was just, Cornell really had struggles with being known as a university because of the hotel school. A lot of people feel that it's a trade school. And a lot of the powers that be at Cornell did not want the hotel school to be the carrier of the brand. Like it really is. There's people like me in Puerto Rico.
And there was a satellite hotel school in Puerto Rico in the 60s and 70s. So.
When the hotel managers got to islands, they transformed because they knew this life of service, this whole theme that comes from the hotel school, which is you serve the communities where you work, you make it better, and you do something that is not done, has never been done before. They learned that all in the hotel school. And then what happened in Puerto Rico, they started bringing tourism from all over the Caribbean, the States, everybody all over the world comes to this island because these hotel managers were doing something that nobody else was doing anywhere in the world. And I remember the hotel managers were talked about in the paper when they got hired by the Hilton.
Yeah.
You know? So that was, you know, watching that disappear. And I was the director of marketing, so we had just done this huge marketing campaign. I really believed in the brand that we went from actually promoting people that were folding napkins to saying, you know, these are global leaders that are basically building industries and economies in islands all over the world, in places all over the world, not just islands. So that kind of fell apart. But at the same time, I was just pursuing and getting older and just saying, you know, do I want to keep living? Like, it was a Pink Floyd. It's like, you know, I was numb, comfortably
right,
numb.
Right.
So that's what, when it fell apart, instead of me then going back, and I had an opportunity to go back into IT, go into project management, which a lot of people in their 50s end up taking, going down from an executive position and then just becoming project managers because they know everything.
Right.
They know how things work. So I had an opportunity when I met John Murray, who was the president of Adventure Sport and Fitness. I'm like, okay, I can't be miserable anymore professionally. This is going to be a huge risk for me, but I'm going to do it because I love fitness and I know that this is my gateway in. And John gave me a really nice opportunity and I took it. so that's how it happened.
Yeah. Sure. Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Let's cut to music.
Sure.
And then we'll come for our last round of questions. What should we play next?
Yeah. So why don't we go into, let's go right into Glitter in the Air.
Okay.
Have you ever fed a lover with just your hands? Close your eyes and trust it, just trust it. Have you ever thrown a fistful of glitter in the air? Have you ever looked fear in the face and said, I just don't care? It's only half past the point of no return, the tip of the iceberg, the sun before the burn, the thunder before the lightning, and the breath before the brains. Have you ever felt this way? Have you ever hated yourself for staring at the phone? Your whole life waiting on the ring to prove you're not alone. Have you ever been touched so gently you had to cry? Have you ever invited a stranger to come inside? It's only half past the point of oblivion. The hourglass on the table, the walk before the run, the breath before the kiss, and the fear before the phrase. Have you ever felt this way? For an endless night, lassoed the moon and the stars and pulled that rope tight. Have you ever held your breath and asked yourself, will it ever get better than tonight?
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Al Gonzalez. So, Al, did you want to say something about Glitter in the Air, or...?
Sure, I think that I picked it because that's my transition into this, you know, looking fear in the eye and telling it I don't care. And that was the song that I played when my mother died in their funeral. I was the one who spoke. And when she died, that's when I started really kind of getting into following my passion, which was leadership development consulting, working with people like Assad. And then also competing in bodybuilding. Like, I actually got on stage on a Speedo, and competed twice or three times. So then I started pursuing my passion. And all that was, I mean, imagine like going down into your undies and having spotlights, and you get painted brown so that your muscles show, and every imperfection in your body is showing. But you get up there anyway, and you flex your muscles, and you bodybuild. That's scary. But it was a passion of mine. To pursue it, and it was looking the fear in the eye and telling it, just don't care.
What was the fear?
There was many.
So, what were they?
The first one, the micro one in bodybuilding, is what I was just articulating. That you have to get down to 6%, 5% body fat, and you are on stage with guys that have been at this point. I was in my late 30s. I never competed before. I started bodybuilding at 32. So I'm not really quite sure what drove me to it. I can't explain it, but something drove me to get on that stage and bodybuild. In tennis, playing tennis as a kid, when I was playing tennis, it was against the rules to lift weights, because the theory was if you become muscle bound, you will not have
a good stroke.
Which was, then if you know who Rafael Nadal is, and then you got decades of pros that were wrong, because this guy comes out and his muscles are bigger than everybody else and pulling people away. So it had nothing to do with the ability to play tennis. So there was a little bit of that, because tennis was, I mean, Dr. Leonard and I just kept going. When Nadal comes out, I'm like, look at this guy's arms, you know? And it was like, I could have been like that my whole youth, you know? I never did it. I always wanted to, remember the Charles Atlas comics that were out when we were kids?
Sure.
I always wanted to be the guy the big guy in the little cartoon in the beach, right? So anyway, but the fear is, well, you know, I'm in my 30s. I came from, at one point I was almost 200 pounds at 5'7". and just not in shape at all. Right. So getting on stage with guys that have been competing 10, 15 years, that was a scary proposition.
Right.
And I just took it as a goal to do that. So there was a lot of fear there, and fear about getting hurt, fear about not dieting enough or dieting too much, and not having enough fluids and cramping on stage, all kinds of different things. It's like I just started overcoming all these obstacles, the daily diet and things like that.
Sure.
to take it to a more macro level, pursuing, you know, this whole thing about do what you want, what you love doing, and never work a day in your life. Well, that's hard to get to. I'm trying to get there.
Right.
But when you take in the career we've been talking about, it wasn't a bad life. It was a pretty nice executive life with good vacations that you could really unplug and not think about work for days or weeks at a time. That's no longer true.
Right.
So, and it was quite a lot of luxuries, a lot of good things that I provided for Amy and I provided for our family. She does very well in real estate, still does. But the fear is, well, you know, I built a 30-year career, and I'm going to walk away from it.
Right.
And the other part was that our marriage just came apart. And it was not because either of us had an affair, or met somebody else, or we fell in love with somebody else. It was just, we really grew apart. You know, she was in real estate, functions, events, dinners, wine, great food, a lot of drinking. And I would go to these things and drink water, and I would make people around me self-conscious.
Right.
And then we would travel and be with my friends who were just eating chicken wings and cake and pizza and beer, and I wouldn't, and they would be self-conscious, and I would, without saying a word, I was making them feel bad. So the marriage fell apart, and my career kind of goes into shambles, and there's a lot of fear in this marriage. I built a life, I built a family, a wonderful family, and I built a career, and at 20, 30 years after working to do that, walking away from both, or thinking that I'm walking away. And my daughter told me a couple of years ago, you never left. I was always kind of punishing myself because I left my kids, I left my family. And I told her that one day, we're watching a movie, and she's like, Dad, you never left.
You continued to be present in their lives.
Yeah.
You didn't check out. My issue was that I, in some sense, emotionally checked out from from my kids at a certain point when things got really hard for me.
Mm.
And that's hard. And so it's good that you didn't.
Yeah. Well, Amy is pretty phenomenal. Amy Wood. She's just Amy Wood Gonzalez. She still has my last name, but she helped me not do that because I could have.
Right.
She blended. And she's a leader herself, so anyway.
And there was care, even though there wasn't an ongoing marriage.
There's absolute love, and I will always love her. Yeah. I tell my partner now, Carol, who is a wonderful woman, who I really, really love, and I'm getting very close with, but anybody that's with me as a partner, they have to understand that Amy's place in my life.
She's a significant and that's particularly hard for people who haven't had women who haven't had children.
Yeah,
to know that there's just this ongoing relationship that's gonna be important.
Yeah.
Right,
it's more important to be parents. Yeah,
I want to switch gears just a little bit. Mm-hmm. What do you do to take care of yourself throughout the day, daily, weekly, monthly, and how do you know you need to do it?
Yeah, so
emotionally, physically, intellectually.
Okay, let's start with physically.
Sure.
That's low line.
That's easy.
We'll get emotional, which is very more important. But I think also the physical care has led me to be more emotionally sound because better nutrition helps with everything.
Right.
Better fitness. Also. One of the mistakes that I made as a bodybuilder was eating too much protein, too much whey, chasing another fourth of an inch on the biceps, or you know, the backs have to be bigger, and that was off balance, right? So what happened was somewhere in my 40s, I discovered what many Ithacans, especially an Ithacan, Ithacans would know that superfoods. You know, you go to they're vegans. They've been here for decades before it became the thing.
And it was called macrobiotic and all sorts of other things.
And I'm trying to remember the name of the restaurant at the Wood Mall, which was well-renowned.
Moosewood?
Yeah, Moosewood.
A long time ago, there was Cabbage Town up in there.
Right. So, anyway, so I discover the real benefit of lentils and avocado, which I grew up with, mm-hmm. by the way.
Yep.
We would pick avocados right, and yep. we would eat them right on the fields, which is, there's nothing like it, and mangoes too. But anyway, avocados, peas, you know, all the superfoods, quinoa. So nutritionally, to answer your question, along when I started actually getting into the superfoods and then understanding how my body needed proper nutrition,
mm-hmm. sure.
That's helped me a lot, and I actually maintain easily without effort. I can be between 8% to 9% body fat year round without mm-hmm. having to diet.
Right.
And that's helped me a lot, because when I was starving myself to be at that level, I was angry and emotionally spent.
What drew you to compete in bodybuilding? What appealed to you?
You know, I think there's a part of me that is competitive. I don't like a lot of competition, and that's why I didn't compete again. But I wanted to prove to myself that I could have a six, not even a six pack. I wanted an eight pack, and I wanted mm-hmm. the obliques that were shredded.
Right.
And I wanted that. I wanted. And there's something about that physicality that is extremely attractive.
Right. And it's taking care of yourself. It's mm-hmm. it's more than the competition. It's seeing how you can
exactly
sharpen yourself.
Yeah. So that was, I think that was the driver. And then I got into the competition and the politics. It reminded me when I was competing
yeah,
in
yeah.
tennis. And I was like, oh, I don't want that any part of it.
Yeah.
And that's what
it's a common story here.
Yeah.
People get interested in something for themselves, and then they compete, and it becomes
yeah.
unsatisfying.
The day that I actually yeah. got close to winning, I didn't want to do it anymore.
Right.
Because I didn't want any part of it. So, but that is a starting answer to what do I do emotionally?
Mm-hmm.
Because even though I'm working harder than I ever had, if you remember, you and I were basically just to sell you this lower body, let me this here. You and I had quite a bit of an interaction just
sure.
for me to find time to take care of what you needed, for
right.
me to find time for you to come to where I work. And this is during the pandemic, so I was just doing curbside.
Right.
Remember, I didn't
yeah,
have
yeah.
the open store at the time.
Yep.
So I'm working really hard, but I'm doing it, I'm following my passion. So I go to Facebook and all these people are posting all these cliche things. I'm like, I'm actually living that. I'm actually in there. I'm actually like listening to the Pink song. And I was like, today, I'm afraid of making 15 mistakes on 20 transactions, right? So people will have to pay me with credit cards. I may screw up a transaction. I may sell the wrong product because we don't have it in inventory yet.
Right.
Or I may screw up a serial number and have the warranty not go into
yeah.
effect. And then somebody like you gets a machine that's $2,000 or $3,000 and they don't have a warranty because I put them the wrong key.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So there's fear everywhere in this job that I have. But emotionally, I'm praying a lot. I'm getting to the point of prayer. My mom was always she was a student of religion.
Mm-hmm.
It was just interesting because we went to a Baptist church, and the Noble Vader, who was our pastor, would tell her that she had to obey my father. And that killed me. That would kill me because my dad was abusive emotionally. He never hit us. Well, he hit me, but not too hard. But I could not stand anybody telling my mom, who I felt was superior
right.
intellectually and loved me more than my dad ever could. This guy from Kentucky would tell my mother that she had to be subservient to my father, who just didn't quite equate to her.
Right.
Anyway, I tell you all that because she taught me how to pray. She taught me how to believe in this God that did not belong in that church, that was not only in that church.
Right.
That church
right.
was part of it, but
not contained or confined by that church.
The relationship with God was, my faith was outside of those confines, right? So emotionally, I've gotten to pray, and my new partner in life, Carol, Carol Smith, is very, she's very educated on scripture, and she knows how to pray, and so we're getting to the point in our relationship where it's almost like pray and meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And she's also a trainer. She's also a personal trainer and a certified cycling instructor. So we actually say that we do pray and reps.
Yeah.
And it's almost like we're growing our faith muscle.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
our faith is getting stronger and bigger because we pray the way that we work out.
That's beautiful.
You know? So we do that. That's the part that's really really cool about my life now, because we get to do that, and I get to have a fuel that actually helps me face fear every day.
That's really neat.
Yeah.
Neat. Al, it has been wonderful to get to know you.
Thank you.
And we're we need to close now. What are we gonna close with? What's the music?
Well, let's close with the dance by Garth Brooks.
Yeah,
I think that's a good thing.
So the symbolism that you have in mind is the symbolism of the awkwardness of the dance of your prior career, of your prior life.
Yeah. That, and I think if we put it in that perspective, then I'm good with it.
Thank you, Al.
Thank you so much.
Looking back on the memory of the dance we shared beneath the stars above. For a moment all the world was right, and how could I have known that you'd ever say goodbye? And now go. Our lives are better left to chance. I could have missed the pain, but I'd have had to miss the dance. Holding you, I held everything. A moment, wasn't I the king? But if I'd only known how the king would fall, hey, who's to say? You know I might have changed it all. And now I'm glad I didn't know the way it all go. Our lives are better left to chance. I could have missed the pain, but I'd have had to miss the dance. Yes, my life is better left to chance. I could have missed the pain, but I'd have had to miss the dance.
Thank you.